30,000 years ago, a man lies dead. But who or what could have killed him? There is no sign of blood. He hasn't fallen from a great height or been crushed by falling debris. There are, however, some scars on his scalp. Perhaps he was killed by a heavy blow. But wait, these scars are old, healed wounds from a long time ago. He has a slightly shortened forearm and a crooked foot, perhaps from a fall, but again, these happened months, maybe years before. These are all healed memories of damage, things that ailed this man, perhaps slowed him down on his final journey across the ancient plain, but none of these injuries killed him. These scars, if anything, are a mark of endurance, proof that he fought, bled, and survived throughout his life. And so what was it that killed him? This ancient man, the ancestor of many humans alive today, was not killed by violence or hunger. His body shows no sign of starvation or predator's claws. No, he was stalked by an enemy he could not defeat through fighting skill or speed, nor evade with intelligence. This killer was a specter, one that had followed him throughout his life, growing as the years passed, stalking him from within, written into his DNA. Evolution had allowed this killer to exist, and it had actually kept him alive, protecting him against other causes of death, until it killed him. From the hours of life experienced by a mayfly to the centuries-long endurance of a sequoia tree, all living things come to an end. Despite the long process of evolution producing an array of astonishing ways to survive and thrive, regeneration, hibernation, reproduction, aging remains inevitable. But if evolution truly is the survival of the fittest, why should living things age at all? What purpose, if any, does aging serve in the grand scheme of natural selection? Evolution clearly has increased the complexity of living things and extended their lifespans, and so why hasn't it solved the great problem of death? Why don't we live forever? Buried beneath layers of dolomitic limestone in South Africa's cradle of humankind, entombed in the dust of a cave that collapsed untold numbers of years ago, was a fossil. And when researchers cleared away the final grains of sediment, a fragment of bone emerged from the stone, smooth, unmistakably human-like, but between 1.6 and 1.8 million years old. This was SK7923, a partial left fifth metatarsal, a foot bone, recovered from the Swartkrans cave site. Though not identified, the fossil comes from an area that has also yielded fossils attributed to Homo ergaster and Paranthropus robustus. But what makes SK7923 unique is that X-ray microtomography showed evidence of malignant osteosarcoma, a type of bone cancer, making it the earliest known case of cancer in a hominin. But the question is, why? This fossil is ancient to us, but it's as old as yesterday when viewed on an evolutionary scale. Around 4 billion years of life had existed on Earth before this hominin had cancer, and in all that time of evolutionary trial and error, of survival of the fittest, life has not eradicated aging and death. In May 1848, Henry Walter Bates reached the Amazon rainforest on a trip that would reveal much about the survival of the fittest. Bates caught the tropical butterflies of the Amazon with nets, examined them in the dim light of his hut, and mounted them carefully on pins. And slowly, through patient observation, he began to notice something strange. Some butterflies, he had learnt, were dangerous for birds to eat. Their caterpillars had fed on plants toxic to bird life, and as a result, the birds had learnt to view their colours as a warning. Eat me and regret it. But flying among these toxic butterflies were entirely unrelated species that looked almost identical, with the same bold red stripes or yellow bands. Predators could not tell the difference, and so avoided them too. The imposters, he realized, survived because of their resemblance to the real thing. When Bates returned to England, he read the work of one Charles Darwin and recognized that he had seen natural selection at work. Natural selection is the engine that drives evolution, not through intention or design, but through persistence, trial and error. Within every population, no two individuals are exactly alike. Those with traits that give them an advantage in a given environment, making them fitter in an evolutionary sense, are more likely to live longer and have the opportunity to produce more young. Those young then inherit those useful traits via their genes, and so those useful traits spread and populations change. Indeed, this is why Bates's butterflies seem to mimic each other. The individuals that resembled the toxic model most closely would live, while those that did not would be eaten. And indeed, this process of selection can happen even more rapidly than we may think. Before Mozambique's civil war, 18.5% of female elephants in Ngorongosa National Park were naturally tuskless. But among those born since the early 1990s, the figure has risen to 33%. Why? Because tusked elephants were targeted by poachers during this chaotic period, while tuskless elephants were spared. The tuskless elephants were more likely to survive and pass on the trait. Selection can be remarkably efficient. And yet this efficiency creates a paradox. If natural selection so effectively eliminates disadvantages, why has it not eliminated the biggest threat to life of all? Aging. If natural selection favors organisms that survive, why, after so many millennia of evolution, do any organisms die at all? In the late 1800s, German biologist August Weismann thought he had the answer. He trained as a physician before turning fully to zoology, drawn to the puzzles of heredity and evolution. Weismann saw age as a negative trait, evolutionarily speaking. Elderly people could not hunt, gather, or fight as effectively, and if the old lingered too long, he suggested, they would even compete with the young for scarce resources. Programmed death, in this view, was adaptive. It cleared the way for new generations, serving the survival of the lineage. Yet objections to this idea included Alfred Russel Wallace, who argued that natural selection acts on individuals, not species, and of course no individual benefits from its own demise. Weismann would go on to ultimately revise his position, but his idea of programmed death sparked debate around the relationship between evolution and aging, with a more promising theory arriving a few decades later. It is the 1920s at University College, London. A man sits alone in a specially designed chamber. The door is closed and tightly sealed. The air tastes strange. He tries to continue writing numbers and short words, but the blood pounds in his head and he begins to wobble on his stool. Still, he tries to keep the pencil moving, but his hand shakes. Everything begins to blur as the pain intensifies in his head until the door cracks open and new air spills in, cool and sharp. The man's father appears, smiling. And John Burden Salderson Haldane smiles back, his vision steadying. Now the chamber is not filled with 7% carbon dioxide. Haldane did not have the most conventional of upbringings. Indeed, his physiologist father had no qualms about bringing his son into his experiments. At 13, he was sent deep-sea diving to work out how to avoid the bends and took a trip down a coal mine to experience the effects of harmful gases deep below the earth. Indeed, perhaps it is no wonder that he developed such a penchant for risk within his own work. He went on to drink acid, sat in decompression chambers to the point of suffering crushed vertebrae and burst eardrums, and reported that the 7% carbon dioxide room gives one a rather violent headache. Haldane risked both injury and death by participating directly in his experiments, but eventually would become a towering figure of early evolutionary biology by investigating the mystery of death itself. Haldane wanted to understand why certain diseases, such as Huntington's, persisted in populations even though they were deadly. Why hadn't they been selected out? The reason for terrible diseases emerging in older age, he suggested, was timing. Indeed, Huntington's typically emerges in middle age, after most individuals have already had children. Haldane argued that natural selection cannot eliminate a disease that strikes only after our genes have been passed on. And in this sense, he said, the later in life a trait appears, the less visible it is to selection. Haldane worked on this concept with Peter Medawar in the 1940s, and called this idea of decreasing evolutionary pressure over an individual's lifetime the selection shadow. And so he saw that evolution matters most in the period where individuals are reproducing. Beyond that, the strength of selection fades into shadow. Death might not be programmed, as Weissmann once suggested, but it was clear that past a certain point, it could simply be ignored. This idea of the indifference of evolution would be expanded on in a way that would capture the public imagination many decades later, by Richard Dawkins in his book The Selfish Gene. Natural selection, he argued, does not operate for the good of the group. It operates at the level of genes, which in a sense use bodies as vehicles for replication. And so from this perspective, what really matters is not whether an organism lives a long and comfortable life, but whether its genes are successfully passed on. Once reproduction has occurred, the fate of the body is of little consequence to the force of evolution, and it is this that has affected our ancestors for millions of years. Today, humans experience a relatively long puberty compared to other species, with full sexual maturity at around 13 to 17 in girls and 15 to 18 in boys. But Australopithecines, our early hominin relatives living around 4 to 2 million years ago, likely matured far earlier than that, at around 8 to 10 years old, much like chimpanzees do. Homo erectus, however, a member of our own genus, perhaps reached adulthood closer to modern humans. The famous Turkana boy fossil, a particularly complete skeleton of Homo erectus youth dated to around 1.5 million years ago, appears to be not yet fully grown at potentially around 8 to 12 years of age, suggesting a longer childhood than earlier pre-human ancestors. And so it seems likely that the selection shadow has been drifting later over our evolutionary journey. But how exactly is this shadow built? Is it just specific diseases, such as Huntington's, that natural selection lets through the net of its protection later in life? Or does the selection shadow involve much more than that? To answer this, we must return to University College London in 1951 and to a lecture with a mysterious title by Haldane's colleague Peter Medawar, An Unsolved Problem of Biology. Addressing his audience that day, of other esteemed scientists, students, and members of the public, Medawar began, "The problem I propose to discuss is that of the origin and evolution of what is commonly spoken of as aging." In this revolutionary lecture, Medawar would illustrate, in concrete and mechanical terms, the extent of the selection shadow, and how it can be built within a human body. All living things accumulate cellular damage. Sometimes, as a result of this damage, they lose their ability to divide, or their repair systems fail. This accumulation leads to organs functioning less well, and the body becomes prone to disease or infection. Indeed, this is the process of aging in concrete terms. And so with diseases like Huntington's, this accumulation of damage matters little to our evolutionary success if genes have already been passed on. Aging, therefore, Medawar argued, was simply the byproduct of survival beyond the age of evolutionary concern. Medawar's theory of mutation accumulation expanded the scope of the selection shadow concept beyond disease to include the small, unperceivable buildup of damage within our bodies, and this theory still stands as one of the primary causes of aging, and why it would still exist today. And so, the work of Haldane and Medawar showed that aging is a consequence of evolution prioritizing youth and fertility. Past our reproductive prime, selection pressure lessens, and the accumulation of mutations and deletions are no longer getting in the way of passing on our genes. Our body's job is done, so to speak, and can slide into disrepair. And so it was with the dead man on the plane 30,000 years ago. His hair, thinning on his head, has been supplied by less melanin from the follicle, turning it a whitish grey. The cell turnover in his nails is decreased, making them rigid, and the keratin that makes the nail plate has lost moisture and oil over time, leaving them brittle. And his skin has been producing less collagen, leading to a loss of elasticity that leaves wrinkles near the corners of his eyes and the slightest sag from under his chin. And so we can see that he'd clearly lived well into the selection shadow. His life was long enough that he'd seen his genes passed on to not one, but two generations. Cellular damage, therefore, would have been long accumulating in his body. And so, was it simply this that killed him? Or is there more to discover? For there is another possibility. Could it be that whatever killed him was not simply ignored due to selection shadow, but instead was something that was actively selected for? Could natural selection have actually chosen the trait that would kill him? An old, stooped Homo sapiens climbs a rocky path, slow and uneven, leaning on a branch as a support. Each step sends pain through her knees and hips, her fingers can barely close around the stick. She stops, often breathing hard, but she keeps going, one foot ahead of the other, grimacing through the pain. Once she was strong, able to run and hunt and swim and climb. Now her joints swell and her body aches. We might think of arthritis as a price paid for modern longevity, but the fossil record shows it was a harsh reality for our ancestors 50,000 years ago too. This arthritic pain will be with the ancient female until she dies. And indeed, the lack of mobility it causes makes her vulnerable to the many dangers of the prehistoric world. She is stalked by a cave lion and will have no chance of outrunning it. But of course, she is old, her genes long passed on, and so there has been no drive for the forces of natural selection to spare her from this tragic fate. But what if it goes further than that? What if she has lived this long, in part due to the exact genes that now give her this pain and vulnerability? What if her DNA contained a genetic Jekyll and Hyde? The fossil record reveals examples of the ailments of old age existing even tens of thousands of years ago in both ancient Homo sapiens and our Neanderthal cousins. Indeed, perhaps the most famous example is the Old Man of La Chapelle-Aux-Saints. Discovered in 1908 in France, this Neanderthal male was around 50 to 60 years old at his death, and his bones revealed severe arthritis had deformed his spine, hips, and shoulders, restricting his mobility. His remains made it clear that age-related conditions like arthritis have existed for at least 60,000 years, confirming they are not just a modern ailment encountered too recently for natural selection to have addressed them. And so what if there is, in fact, a reason that they are there? What if the genes that cause the diseases of aging, like arthritis, are selected for? The sky had turned a hazy color of rust, sirens wailed throughout the valley, and the Paradise, California wildfire had burnt outside for hours. And in one house, a manuscript begins to cinder, an autobiography by George C. Williams that would be lost to the fire in his son's house. The details of the book were doubtlessly a great loss. Williams, a biology professor, was a character. Some described him as something of a curmudgeon, but others loved his directness. Indeed, he wrote all his notes in Icelandic, despite not being Icelandic himself. His collaborator, Randolph Ness, said he had a fascination with aspects of bodies and minds that just didn't seem to make sense in evolutionary terms. He is seen today as the father of evolutionary medicine, the idea of viewing disease and searching for their causes through the lens of evolution. Williams would die at 84. The disease that killed him was Alzheimer's, a common disease of old age, and in this case, an ironic one. Indeed, it was diseases like Alzheimer's that so fascinated Williams. Why have such diseases at all? Why should they exist within us? The solution Williams came up with would influence evolutionary biologists forever after. For in 1957, at the age of just 31, Williams published a paper that changed how scientists thought about aging. Titled Pleiotropy, Natural Selection and the Evolution of Senescence, it argued a controversial idea that aging is not the result of forgotten biology, but the logical outcome of how genes are selected. He, like Haldane, was working in this new era of DNA, genes, and the fundamental basis of natural selection. William saw aging as not the forgotten byproduct of a reproducing animal, but as collateral damage. He worked off Haldane and Medwar's principles that the key driver of evolution is reproductive fitness, not health or comfort or longevity for its own sake. Therefore, he argued, if a gene improves fertility early in life, it will be favored by natural selection even if it carries damaging consequences later. So genes with multiple effects, what geneticists call pleiotropy, can create trade-offs where the effects are opposite in different life stages. Williams called it antagonistic pleiotropy, a genetic Jekyll and Hyde. Imagine a young Homo sapiens male. He stands at the edge of a river, breath steaming in the cold dawn. He picks up a rock, hurls it across the water to feel the strength of his throwing arm. He is strong, and growing stronger through hunting and through butchering and hauling his prizes home. However, his strength has not gone unnoticed. Other males have admired his skills and sought alliances with him. A number of females have made their intentions clear too. Years pass. The group has moved many times, and his children have grown tall and strong. His hair is beginning to grey, but the muscles of his body, although slightly diminished, are still impressive. However, his biology has made him destined to burn bright and fast. For the testosterone that made him so successful will betray him. He stands at the side of a new river, picks up a stone, and feels a tightening in his chest. High levels of testosterone are associated with greater fertility, higher libido, and social dominance in young men, all traits that historically would have translated into more children and more chance of passing on genes. But later in life, the same hormonal profile is linked to higher risks of prostate cancer, cardiovascular disease, and shortened life. And so clearly, the benefits come when it matters for evolution, and the price is paid when it no longer matters. The lineage is already secured. And it was a similar trade-off for the old man of La Chapelle. Certain genes can promote a strong inflammatory response that might have been beneficial for surviving infections in ancient environments, can also increase the risk of age-related inflammatory diseases, like rheumatoid arthritis. This can also be seen in BRCA genes. Today, they are known as massively raising the risk of breast and ovarian cancer, often striking in a woman's 30s and 40s. Yet some evidence suggests that they might once have conferred a slight immune advantage, or even higher fertility, keeping them in circulation despite their dangers. And so Williams' theory was a breakthrough that allowed other scientists to push the idea further, even down to the cellular level. In 1977, British biologist Tom Kirkwood proposed a theory that many consider, alongside mutation accumulation and antagonistic pleiotropy, to be the third great theory of aging, disposable soma theory. The soma is the body, the mass of cells and organs that carry our genes. Kirkwood argued that evolution forces a budgetary choice. Energy is finite, and an organism can spend it on reproduction or on long-term repair and maintenance, but not both at full speed. Natural selection channels resources towards reproduction, gearing cells to undertake actions that help fertility and child-rearing, like sperm production. However, less energy is spent on repairing cells, as they accumulate damage. This means that bodies are maintained just long enough to ensure reproductive success, after which maintenance inevitably declines. In a sense, this is not a design flaw, this is the design. Different species show the principle in extreme forms. The Pacific salmon expends itself entirely in a single spawning run. It hurls itself upstream, mates, and then dies, collapsing under the strain. Mayflies are even more extreme. Some live as adults for less than a day, their only purpose to mate before they fall to their deaths. Then there are creatures like the bowhead whale, which invests heavily in cellular repair and can live for more than 2 centuries. But of course, even these are not immortal. Every living body carries a trade-off between maintenance and reproduction. Humans fall somewhere in the middle. Our repair systems sustain us through several decades of fertility, but then maintenance falters. DNA errors accumulate, leading to cancers, and immune systems weaken. And so in a sense, death In this view, it's not a catastrophic failure, but the gradual exhaustion of a maintenance budget. We do not die because evolution wants us to, but because evolution has driven our bodies to prioritize our younger, fertile years, even when that directly negatively impacts our later ones. And so, we now return to our cold case on the ancient plain. It's time to look past the wrinkles of his skin and delve beneath, inside, his body. What does his network of organs and arteries and veins tell us? Is there a sign of a heart attack, antagonistic pleiotropy at work? It doesn't appear so. Neither are there tumors or infections or arthritis or Parkinson's. And so we can look deeper at the microscopic elements of his body. What do his cells tell us? Did they simply run out of energy? His body, having spent its resources on survival rather than repair, a slow degradation. There is damage, but nothing catastrophic, wear and tear on the fringes of his organs. Yet still, the killer is unclear. It's only when we return to the outside of his body that we see it. Not a wound or a bruise, but the shape of his body itself. His body is narrow, the limbs thin and drawn, the muscle wasted not by famine, but by a long, subtle, unseen process. It is clear that the answer lies deeper than flesh or bone, deeper even than the cell. To find it, we must look into what wrote the blueprint of this body before it ever began to live. And in journeying towards this answer, we must also settle something else. Why do old people even exist? It is the early 1950s, and America is waking up to the Today Show. The camera pans across a sleek New York studio. The audience begins to clap, and onto the stage waddles a small chimpanzee dressed in human clothes. He claps his hands, grins, and leaps onto the desk. The host offers him a cup of coffee, which he pretends to sip before spitting dramatically into a bin. The audience laugh and cheer. This chimp was J. Fred Muggs, one of the most famous animal celebrities. Born in Cameroon, but brought to New York as an infant, Muggs became a regular part of the Today Show, getting up to various antics, like playing the drums and mimicking his human colleagues. But perhaps just as astonishing as his career is his longevity. Born in 1952, J. Fred Muggs lived to over 70 years old. However, this is a special case and makes him one of the oldest living chimpanzees in history. Wild chimpanzees rarely live beyond their 30s, and life expectancy at birth is around 19 years, highlighting the dangers of living in the natural world. And so were the lives of our hominin ancestors once as short as wild chimpanzees? And if so, when and why did this change? To begin with, what do lifespan and life expectancy really mean? Lifespan is often given as a maximum age, the longest amount of time a particular species has been observed to or could potentially live. The term life expectancy, however, usually refers to the average number of years a newborn can expect to live, given their environment. The life expectancy of someone born in the USA today is very different to someone born in medieval Germany, or even someone born in many other countries. But averages can mislead. The life expectancy of someone born today in Chad, for example, is just 59. But when you look at the life expectancy of someone in Chad who has made it to their fifth birthday, that figure jumps to 66. Why? Because they've made it past one of the hardest parts of life. And indeed, human life is full of hard parts. These hard parts are scientifically called mortality risks, and they can be extrinsic or intrinsic. Extrinsic mortality refers to risks that come from the outside world, for example, predators, accidents, infections, violence, or famine, whereas intrinsic mortality refers to the body's internal processes, for example, risks from genetic disease, cancer, and gradual cellular decline. And it is really the balance between these two things that has shaped the story of human life expectancy. extrinsic risks are particularly high at different times for different people. But for all of us, the very first years of our life are probably the most dangerous. Indeed, pre-modern medicine, human babies faced a difficult time staying alive. In medieval Europe, it is estimated from records that almost a third of infants died before their first birthday. Babies today are more likely to survive, but still, in some of the poorest countries in the world, babies dying in their first year is not uncommon. For example, in Afghanistan, around 10% of all infants die in their first year of life. Of course, humans in our infancy, and in particular our very first days, are incredibly vulnerable. We are born entirely dependent on our carers, with immature immune systems and weak thermoregulation. Diseases like diarrhea, pneumonia, and sepsis regularly claimed infant lives before modern medicine. And even deeper in our evolutionary history, we would also have been at greater risk from the world around us, exposed to the elements and predators of the natural world. The tongue child, a fossil of Australopithecus africanus, was only 3 years old when they died. Their skull is scored by talon marks in its eye sockets, marks similar to those left on modern monkeys attacked by African crowned eagles. It looks like this child from 2.8 million years ago was attacked, and possibly snatched, by a great eagle. Another Australopithecus child skull from South Africa, known as SK54, shows puncture marks from leopard's teeth. And yet to survive childhood was not the end. It meant facing new challenges. For example, for our ancestors, if they were female, they would potentially face the risks of pregnancy and childbirth. Before modern obstetrics, labor and the immediate weeks after delivery carried around 6 times the normal risk of death. Hemorrhage, sepsis, obstructed labor, all were deadly in the absence of medical intervention. And for men, the danger was different, but no less present. Anthropologists studying hunter-gatherer groups find that adolescence and young adulthood are highly perilous. Young men take on hunting roles, risking injuries from prey and predators, and fight rival clans for territory. Male mortality spikes in those years in hunter-gatherer societies, just as maternal mortality spikes in reproductive age for women. These different risks created an uneven landscape of survival, but the pattern is clear. Get through childhood, dodge the hazards of early adulthood, and your chance of reaching old age raises significantly. And older people do appear in the fossil record. Mungo Man, who lived in Australia around 40,000 years ago, was so well preserved that scientists were able to age him to around 50 at the time of his death, similar to the estimated age of Neanderthal specimens Lafarassi 1 and Shanidar 5, both dated to around 50,000 years ago. And indeed, older specimens aren't limited to only the time of our species, the oldest evidence of which is around 300,000 years old. However, tooth wear studies do show that Homo sapiens and Neanderthal populations sustained a larger share of older adults than the hominins and even the earlier species of Homo that came before them. Early hominins, such as Sahelanthropus tridensis and Australopithecus afarensis, likely shared short, precarious life expectancy, similar to modern chimps. Their bodies show rapid growth and early maturity, a pattern more like non-human apes than humans. Indeed, the work of American professor Caleb E. Finch has not only found a doubling of life expectancy since the year 1800, perhaps not surprising when we consider modern medicine, diet, and living standards, but also another, more ancient increase. He found that across the roughly 300,000 generations between 1800 and the last common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees, our ancestors' life expectancy had already doubled once before. But what is the cause of this increased life expectancy? One obvious reason is reduced extrinsic mortality due to the development of technology and cooperation. The leopard, for example, that killed Australopithecus SK54 is less dangerous to a group of hominins armed with stone weapons, fire, and housed in some form of shelter. If this group can communicate, share a knowledge of potential leopards and how to avoid them, its members are at much less risk, increasing their life expectancy further. But does this explain everything? Was it simply that our advanced tools and intelligence became a trump card, protecting us well into the selection shadow of our lives? Or are there different reasons for old people to exist. An old woman sits at the entrance of a crude shelter made of wood and hides. Silver hair, wrinkled skin, wiry frame. Two small children play beside her, tapping sticks together and rolling pebbles along the ground. She keeps them close. Every so often, she offers them a little food or swipes at their feet to admonish them for bad behavior. She starts preparing something for the children to eat, hacking at some fruit with a roughly hewn blade. Her joints ache, but she flexes her fingers to ease the pain. However, these are not the old woman's children. These are her grandchildren. Her own daughter is out foraging, armed with the knowledge her mother can continue to give her into her adult life. She's known many droughts, many lean times, many storms, and now her skills and knowledge can also be passed down to new generations, allowing her to contribute to the evolutionary success of her genes long after reproductive age. And so grandmothers may have been some of the most important parts of our evolutionary history, and a driver of our longer life, as shown by the uniqueness of human life after menopause. Menopause marks the end of reproductive life in women and is almost unique to humans. While some female animals in captivity can survive for a while after the end of their reproductive period, it is only human women and a handful of whale species that show universal menopause with a long post-reproductive stage. And so if natural selection only cares about reproductive health, why does menopause exist, and this long period of life after the end of menstruation? One suggestion is known as the grandmother hypothesis. Anthropologist Kristin Hawkes was observing older Hadza women in northern Tanzania dig for tubers when she found herself asking, why do women live so long after they stop bearing children? The answer Hawkes advanced, along with colleagues James O'Connell and Nicholas Blurton-Jones, was that they lived because they were useful. Older women, far from being evolutionarily spent, improved the survival of their grandchildren by providing food and care, in addition to their parents, and also allowing parents more time to generate food and other necessities for them and the wider group. By taking on some parenting responsibilities, the hypothesis went, grandmothers freed up mothers to have more children, increasing the number of their surviving descendants and carrying on the genes that supported longevity beyond reproduction. And indeed, ethnographic data from the Hadza of Tanzania did seem to support the idea. Children with grandmothers nearby were more likely to survive into adulthood. And indeed, it's not only the transfer of knowledge and skills that older people can provide, but also some other, more active roles can be best filled by those with experience. For example, hunting. Various studies have shown that while the success of foraging and fishing activities can peak by the age of 20, men's hunting success peaks in the age range of 35 to 50, long after many of these men in hunter-gatherer societies are grandfathers. And so it would appear that older humans were not simply protected from the risks of extrinsic mortality by the technology of their species, but were key players in the knowledge and use of this technology. As generations passed, our ancestors gained a larger variety of skills to be passed on, woven into an ever more complex web of culture. A 2004 study by Rachel Kaspari and Sang-Hee Lee pinpointed a specific window within the history of hominins where life expectancy increased. They analyzed 768 human fossils dating back 3 million years, and after aging them, an astonishing statistic emerged. After entering the Upper Paleolithic period, around 30,000 years ago, there was a five-fold increase in the number of individuals surviving into old age. Kaspari said in an interview, "In the Upper Paleolithic, the proportion just skyrocketed. It was unbelievable. We didn't expect that." They would go on to suggest that older adulthood is a critical demographic factor in the development of human culture. In their paper, "The Old Become Common," elders could become cultural libraries, passing on useful knowledge and skills that kept their direct descendants alive and able to pass on the long life genes they had inherited. And indeed, it is clear, the dead man on the ancient plain lived just such a life. for he lived not only long enough to pass on his genes, but to ensure their success by passing on his knowledge to multiple generations. His crooked foot was an injury sustained whilst hunting. Many decades into his life, he would have passed on this knowledge to younger hunters, whilst also ensuring the success of many hunts that would feed his community. But what was it that caused his body to finally become frail? What was it that brought this long, successful life to an end? This man lived right in the period of the fivefold increase of old age individuals in our history, a boom in life expectancy that actually would decline just after the close of the Upper Paleolithic. The transition to the Neolithic, when people settled and began farming, should have been a time of plenty, but at first, we faced new challenges. Living in larger, denser communities increased exposure to infectious disease. While reliance on crops before storage and preserving technologies had developed meant vulnerability to famine. Archaeological evidence shows that in early farming societies, lifespans fell compared to hunter-gatherers. Malnutrition, epidemics, and social inequality cut lives short. It was only much later, with improvements in sanitation and eventually medicine, that lifespans began to climb again. And of course, the greatest improvement came in the 20th century, a time of massive medical advancement. Today, humans live longer than ever before in our history. As we've seen before, this longevity lies partly in our genes. Perhaps meddling with those genes could halt the aging process altogether. Indeed, advances in gene therapy make this idea seem not entirely fictional. Could the future be one in which we can live forever? Deep beneath the Arctic ice, a Greenland shark glides slowly through the dark. It hasn't noticed in its slow traversing of the deep sea, but this shark has lived through the time of the English Civil War, the birth of modern science, the Industrial Revolution, and both world wars. It was already ancient when humans first landed on the moon. It has lived through four centuries. Using radiocarbon dating of proteins in 28 sharks' eye lenses, scientists have found that these slow-growing predators likely reach sexual maturity only after around 150 years. Indeed, one female was perhaps born in the early 17th century and was still swimming when the study was published. The Greenland shark is the longest-lived vertebrate known, with lifespans estimated at up to 390 years. Its secret is partly its environment, cold waters, slow metabolism, delaying aging, but it also tells us something. What counts as a long time is relative. Whales, turtles, and sharks live longer than even the longest-lived human. And so why can some animals delay the inevitable for so long? To understand this, it's useful to look at Peto's paradox. Named after epidemiologist Richard Peto, the paradox arises from a simple observation. Cancer, one of the biggest killers of those who live to an older age, is caused by mutations in cells. The more cells an organism has, and the longer it lives, the more opportunities there are for mutations to accumulate. And so by that logic, large, long-lived animals should be riddled with cancer. A blue whale has 1,000 times more cells than a mouse, and lives decades longer, so it should be a cancer factory. And yet elephants, despite their size and long lives, have far lower cancer rates than humans. Why? Scientists believe it is because they carry multiple copies of a genome protector called TP53. Sometimes called the guardian of the genome, this gene acts as a vigilant quality control officer, scanning DNA for damage and halting cells from dividing when their code goes wrong. If the flaws can be repaired, TP53 coordinates the fix. If not, it orders the cells to self-destruct. The gene itself is ancient, far older than our own species. Variants of TP53 appear more than 1 billion years ago, long before animals, plants, or fungi took their modern forms. In the microbial world of early Earth, where radiation, ultraviolet light, and reactive oxygen molecules constantly bombarded living cells, DNA damage was inevitable. The first TP53-like proteins evolved in single-celled organisms as rudimentary guards, molecular systems that detected errors in genetic material and paused the cell cycle long enough for repair. As multicellular life evolved, this role became much more important. As cells began cooperating, passing chemicals between one another, they became vulnerable. A single mutation could now endanger not just one cell, but the integrity of an entire organism, like a single brick falling and taking the entire wall with it. More cells meant more divisions, more mutations, and more chances for a cell to start reproducing out of control, the cause of tumors. And so in this new, multicellular world, TP53 acted as the control center, halting replication, summoning repair enzymes, and, if the damage couldn't be fixed, triggering apoptosis, programmed death of the cell to prevent a tumor from ever forming. The role of TP53 mirrors the complexity of the organism it protects. In humans, it coordinates hundreds of genes involved in DNA repair, cell cycle controls, metabolism, and immune response. It can even influence how cells respond to stress, starvation, or viral infection. But like any complex system, it has weak points. For when TP53 itself is damaged, the consequences are profound. Roughly half of all human cancers contain mutations that silence or corrupt this gene, stripping cells of their ability to protect themselves. And so TP53 may have evolved primarily to protect us through the years of fertility, ensuring survival long enough to reproduce, but it continues to defend us long after that evolutionary mandate has been met. It is a relic of life's earliest struggles, still performing the same essential task: to hold the line against cancer for as long as possible. And TP53 is the key to why big animals can outlive smaller ones. Mice have only one copy of the gene, while elephants have 20. Bigger animals have simply evolved better cancer defenses. The presence of TP53 raises an obvious question. If some animals have evolved ways to suppress cancer and extend their lifespans, why don't all animals do the same? Why have humans not loaded up their genome with TP53 copies and other protective mechanisms, thus creating bodies that could maintain themselves indefinitely? Well, the answer comes back to George C. Williams and antagonistic pleiotropy, the principle where a single gene affects multiple traits, with one trait being beneficial in earlier life and another being detrimental in latter life. TP53 helps protect us from cancer by stopping damaged cells from growing. However, it is, ironically, particularly prone to mutation. This means the more copies of the gene we have, the more chances there are for one of them to mutate. And if a mutation happens in a way that disrupts TP53's protective function, it can actually increase cancer risk rather than reduce it. If a harmful TP53 mutation causes cancer in early life, it may kill you before you can reproduce. And as we know, evolution always favors reproductive fitness. And yet still, some species have developed extraordinary ways to keep going. Galapagos tortoises, for example, can live more than a century. But what about true biological immortality? Is there any creature on Earth that truly never dies? For that, we have to turn to the sea, and not the Greenland shark. We have to go to much more temperate waters, and find the so-called immortal jellyfish, Teratopsis dawnii. This incredible organism can rejuvenate essentially indefinitely. When stressed or injured, its adult body, the medusa stage, collapses and transforms into a tiny blob-like mass, which then attaches to a surface, like a rock or a piece of coral, and becomes a polyp, the same form it had as a juvenile. From this polyp, new jellyfish buds grow, genetically identical to the original, like a little factory line of clones. In essence, it reprograms its body back to youth, restarting its life cycle without reproducing sexually. It would be like a human shrinking back to a fetus. And in principle, it can repeat this process indefinitely, dodging death by becoming young again. And other organisms also almost reach immortality, but in different ways. Hydra, tiny freshwater animals continually regenerate their cells and show no signs of aging under laboratory conditions. Some clams live for centuries simply by keeping their metabolism extraordinarily slow. Tardigrades can dehydrate themselves into little dry husks and remain dormant for hundreds of years before reanimating at the touch of water. But of course, these creatures are relatively simple compared to us. Complexity makes immortality much harder. A jellyfish can reset because it has no brain to preserve, no complex tissues to coordinate, but humans cannot turn back into embryos. And yet, surprisingly, there is hope for those among us who do wish to live forever. For in theory, nothing in biology rules out reaching human immortality through technological means. Aging is, after all, simply a buildup of failures. DNA mutations, telomere shortening, protein misfolding. If each of those could be fixed, in principle, aging could be stopped or reversed. Already, scientists are experimenting with gene editing to mimic the extra TP53 copies of elephants, drugs to boost DNA repair, and stem cell therapies to rejuvenate tissues. Anti-aging research is a fast-growing field, with billionaires funding labs that promise to cure aging, and people biohacking their own bodies in an attempt to extend their life. Who knows what the future may bring? And so, though TP53 has been called the guardian of the genome, it is still not safe from the Jekyll and Hyde effects of antagonistic pleiotropy. Thus, we finally find the killer of the man lying on the plane 30,000 years ago. He was not killed in a fight with a man or a beast. Despite his high testosterone, he didn't suffer a heart attack. He did not develop cancer, protected by the TP53 within his genome. In the end, TP53, the gene that helps complex animals escape cancer, hunting down damaged cells and destroying them, became a victim of its own success. Year after year in this man's body, TP53 was shutting down cells, reducing the reserves of healthy stem cells, inhibiting the repair of tissue damage. By the end, the very gene that kept him alive became part of the machinery of aging, tipping the man towards frailty, and finally, an end. But of course, not before the many beginnings of the new generations he oversaw. Lifespan and life expectancy have changed dramatically since the time of our ancestors, through many millennia of evolution. From the beginnings of hominins, perhaps living only as long as wild chimpanzees, through to the explosion of old-age humans 30,000 years ago, and all the way up to today, where our lives are the longest they've ever been. Indeed, our lives are long enough to raise children, grandchildren, sometimes even great-grandchildren, and give them the skills they need for their lifetimes. Human lives are long enough to build cultures like nothing ever seen before on our planet. And so our lives might be short compared to the long history of our species, but they are long enough to live a life that matters. You've been listening to the entire history of humankind. Thanks again to Planet Wild. If you want to join a community that makes a difference to nature, check out their mission, Restoring the American Prairie. Thanks for watching. I will see you next time.